It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This week, a video was released showing an Arizona officer using his police cruiser to intentionally run down a suspect. This is the latest event involving police officers' use of force. It comes shortly after the shooting death of Walter Scott as he was running away by an officer in South Carolina. Are law enforcement officials using an increasing amount of sometimes deadly force? And if so, why is it happening? I'm joined now on the phone by University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's good to be with you. Thanks.
If you have a comment or question, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. And again, the number 412-246-2002. David, most of these cases have one thing in common, video. How has the wide availability of citizen video of these unfortunate encounters, particularly the one in South Carolina, how has that the video of these encounters changed how we understand them?
Well, Paul, the change has been dramatic. You know, I go into classrooms all the time or into teaching situations, and I often ask how many people are holding right now in a hand or a pocket a fully capable video audio recording system. And most of the hands go up because that's what's in a smartphone. And with video by citizens becoming so common, it is increasing the chances that any particular police encounter will be recorded and then distributed. And that, I think, makes a fundamental shift in how we perceive our police and how we understand what they're doing. Now, I don't think that we are actually seeing more use of force than we have in the past, even though it seems like it. I know, because it's just incident after incident. There's no data that suggests that that's true. What we are witnessing, though, is a greater awareness largely because of video. And the impact of this is really profound because up until the video, the portable video and phones era, if a police officer made a report that said such and such happened, the defendant assaulted me, so I had to do thus and so and use force, that was the narrative that applied. And nobody was going to believe the defendant next to a police officer because, after all, the defendant has a lot to lose and wants to prove his case so he can get off. Now that's different. Selectively, not always for certain, but different. And that's because there can now be a counter-narrative when that was never possible before. And the South Carolina case really brings that home because, as you saw, I know many of your listeners saw, you see that video and you see one story, and it's exactly, totally, completely different from the story that the officer put in his report before he knew there was video. And after that, you know, things changed dramatically. And if not for the video, which only happened by chance, the police officer's story would have been accepted. He'd probably be out on patrol today instead of charged with murder. It's that dramatic.
Well, right. And what the South Carolina case in particular highlights is not only if it's the police officer's word against the suspect's word, the police officer's word will be taken in most cases, and especially if the suspect, as is the case here, if the suspect is dead, the suspect can't say anything. So here we have an officer we see on video that he not only shot the suspect as the suspect was running away, that there seems to be a pretty clear indication that the officer's life was not threatened, and that in addition to that, the officer was rearranging evidence at the scene to corroborate whatever story he was about to tell.
Well, absolutely. And what you can see in that video by his casualness is that he seemed to have not a care in the world, not only about what he'd done, but about the covering it up and the rearranging of the evidence. That shows you, I don't know that he killed anybody before, but he had not done this that day for the first time. This was somebody who had done these kind of things before, had put his word out there before and expected it to be taken, and why should this time be different?
And I guess what's sad about this, what makes you wonder, is how many times over the decades in the history of this country has this thing happened, and there was just nothing to prove that it had happened?
Well, exactly. And I think this is one of the things that's making this a different kind of moment than we have had in the past. Often, accusations like this are made by people, particularly people of color. They say that force was used on them when it was not warranted. And nobody can tell if how many times that's actually true or not true, but it is almost always discounted by the fact that you know the police will simply say, well, of course he says that. He wants to get off. He wants to say that we did something wrong when he's the criminal. And now, like I said, people have an alternative story that comes in that may, in certain circumstances, be believable. And now people are having to reexamine their assumptions. If they always assume that that was never true, they simply cannot assume it anymore, which is not to say, of course, that police always do this or this happens all the time. We don't know that. Our data on this, as I said, is very poor. But we do know it can no longer be denied that it happens. We know it does.
The recent case in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has brought to light something that I don't think a lot of us were aware of. Post-Gazette columnist Tony Norman delved into this in a column he wrote earlier this week, and that's that a law enforcement volunteer named Bob Bates, who apparently donated thousands of dollars to the sheriff's department, became what they call a reserve sheriff. And on April 2nd, Mr. Bates shows up on the scene after an unarmed black suspect named Eric Harris has been captured. And after someone calls for a taser, one of the officers is calling for the taser to be used because the suspect is struggling, even though he clearly is not going to get away. A video recording indicates Bates pulling out his gun and shooting Harris, who dies shortly thereafter. Mr. Harris's family insisted that the video of this be released, and Mr. Bates was charged this week with second-degree manslaughter. Is this a whole new level, David, of irresponsibility on the part of law enforcement that we're seeing here?
Well, it certainly seems to be in this situation. A lot of police departments use auxiliary officers or volunteer officers for certain kinds of tasks. It's not uncommon at all. And they are trained, they get some degree of responsibility. In some places they carry weapons and in others they don't. And there's nothing wrong with that in principle. But usually those volunteer officers are used for much different kinds of tasks, controlling traffic, showing up at special events, representing the department in other kinds of public settings. What they did here was they put this guy in as part, maybe a backup part, a secondary part, but as part of a sting operation involving illegal guns. And to me, that is the height of irresponsibility in terms of the assignment. I just can't fathom how they thought that that was a good idea and that this guy was prepared for it. And, of course, the other thing is that this man, Mr. Bates, had given a lot of money and equipment and favors to the department and to the sheriff, even taking the sheriff on vacation. So if you were an officer on the scene, the commanding officer on the scene of this sting, and Bob Bates shows up and he says, well, I'm assigned to this too, you know that he's connected in and he's a good friend of the sheriff. Are you going to, you know, are you going to actually tell him, no, you got to get over there, I don't want you here? I mean, it disrupts the chain of command. And so this is a very serious set of breaches, and it's not just about having civilian volunteers. That's fine, but you have to use them in the correct ways, let alone giving them the right training. And there's evidence now I'm seeing coming out in the media that some of the training records may have been tampered with or falsified, which would be a whole other level of problems.
The person who shot the South Carolina video waited to release it because they wanted to see how the police department would handle the shooting, apparently. Are police departments acting quicker to release information because there could be video contradicting or supporting the narrative of what happened?
Well, some are and some aren't. I think the wise ones are. It's not necessarily because of video, but because of public pressure to know what happens when a catastrophic or tragic situation occurs and police end up killing a civilian. They want information. This police department may or may not have done that, but what I understand from the South Carolina case is that the young man who took the video was actually afraid to have it. He did not want to have it even on his phone, considered destroying it. He was afraid that he would be retaliated against if it was found on him. And he ultimately decided, instead of going to the police, which he felt was simply too dangerous to him, he gave it to the family. The family gave it to the New York Times, and that's how come we're seeing it. So it's a sign that something there is terribly wrong. If you don't think that your police department can be trusted with video recording that one of their officers shot a guy in the back who was running away, there is such a deep level of distrust in a situation like that. You've got very deep problems.
And I wanted to bring up a report regarding the Eric Garner incident in New York. This was the man who was choked and was suffocated to death on Staten Island. And there was a report recently that the person who shot that video, this was another civilian video, that this person has been harassed by either directly or indirectly by law enforcement officials. And one of the questions it raises is that what are the police doing in terms of encouraging and or discouraging people to take videos? Clearly, there's been an indication that police want video if it helps them to apprehend a criminal. But in a case like this that makes them look bad, they may not want that video, and they may, as was the fear of the person in South Carolina, there may be a fear of retaliation.
Yes, and I think that's really unfortunate. I mean, we talk a lot about people's willingness to come to the police to give them information, the fear of being targeted if you are seen as a police informant or a snitch, all these things. But it has to be a two-way street. If police want you to come out and give information to them when you see wrongdoing, recording police activity out in public when you are not interfering cannot be seen as, should not be viewed as an anti-law enforcement activity. Police don't have any right to get in your face or arrest you for that, though that does happen. And it's unfortunate. This is the world we live in now. Efforts to harass people into not doing this or arresting them, they're not going to work over the long term, and they're simply deepening the distrust that some people feel of our law enforcement folks. And that's not good for anybody. Law enforcement needs public support. And to the extent that their efforts are seen as trying to stymie public accountability, things like that, I mean, that's just a step in the wrong direction at best.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the increase in violent events that have been captured on video. Not necessarily, says David, an increase in police use of deadly force, but just the perpetuation of videos because of the mobile devices that people have now that can shoot those videos. They're coming up more and more. We're seeing more of what happens that some police might not want you to see. We'll talk more about whether that's a good thing. We'll refer to that incident we mentioned earlier in Arizona and what the law says about the use of force by police. And we'll take your calls at 412-246-2002. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the proliferation of videos often shot by citizens, civilians, of police incidents involving excessive use of force. We're wondering about whether this is part of a pattern of police violence. There have been a number of incidents that have come up across the country, including one most recently in Arizona showing an officer using his police cruiser to intentionally run down a suspect. We're going to ask our guest, David Harris, about that. He is a Pitt Law professor at the University of Pittsburgh. You can join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM on Twitter at ESSPGH. David, police in Arizona this week said that an officer who intentionally used his car to run into a suspect who was carrying a rifle probably saved lives. And the police chief in this town near Tucson said that the officer made the right decision. Assuming that you have seen this video, David, what do you think?
I have seen the video, Paul, and I could not agree less. actually, with that statement. You know, it all turned out fine because the guy lived, but there was every chance that this man would have been killed because he was rammed at a relatively high speed by a heavy vehicle. You can see him flipping through the air. The car was going fast enough that it went through a retaining wall and was badly damaged. And the things to watch in this video are that the other officers on the scene seem to have the situation under control. They were following this man. He was not then threatening anybody except maybe himself. It was a volatile situation, to be sure, and he was armed, no doubt about that. But when the officer decides he's going to take matters into his own hands and he begins to drive very quickly, very fast toward the suspect, the other officer on the scene calls him and says, no, don't do it, don't do it, stop, what are you doing? And you can hear the exasperation in his voice when he sees what happens with the man flipping through the air. I mean, I just think, number one, it was completely unnecessary. Number two, you know, while it's a use of force that turned out okay, I think the discussion would be different if that guy was dead.
I don't know how after seeing the video, I have no idea how that man survived.
It is really puzzling. I mean, I don't know either. But the idea that this was the best alternative of the possible outcomes here, just because, you know, he lived and nobody else was hurt, I find that hard to accept, especially when the other officers on the scene seem to have matters under some kind of control and they seem to have a plan.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with David Harris of the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Let's go to Sam in East Liberty. Sam, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
As a black male and a father of young black males, teenagers now, I'm just looking forward to the day where all police officers wear body cameras and also have video cameras in their vehicles, because for so long there's just been so much brutality that's going unreported, and there's been stories that have been, I've known several times where people have been harassed and wrongly violated by the police, and there were stories made up in regards to making excuses for that. So just as a parent of young black males, I'm looking forward to the day that all police carry body cameras. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate the phone call. David, we're hearing that the Pittsburgh police, that inroads are being made by the city to equip Pittsburgh police officers with those body cameras. What impact does all of this have on the current debate about body cameras for police? And are you in favor of what Mayor Peduto wants to do, and that's to equip the Pittsburgh police with body cameras?
Paul, I think that the Ferguson incident and all the ones that have followed have really given very strong impetus to this idea of putting cameras on officers. And on the whole, I do favor it. I think it's a good idea, and I hope we get to go forward in Pittsburgh in a reasonable way. It's important to say that body cameras are not a silver bullet. They don't change the law. They don't change grand jury systems. They don't change whatever problems we would have with use of force. What they do superbly, if they're in use, is they can make a record that, to one degree or another, will put certain facts beyond dispute. And that's exactly what you see in South Carolina and so many other cases. It's not possible to argue from what we see in the South Carolina video, that man was a threat to the police officer when the police officer shot him. So it will make a record. It will also be a good evidence collector. And there is strong evidence that it civilizes people on both sides of the camera. What I mean by that, and I'll just paraphrase here a quote from a chief who has tested these devices in his own department in a random experiment. He said, basically, when you got a camera there, everybody behaves a little bit better. The civilians do and the officers do. And the proof was in the pudding. The data from his department, which was Rialto, California, showed that civilian complaints against police officers wearing cameras were down 90%, that's 90, as opposed to officers without cameras. And officers with cameras used force 60% less often than officers with cameras. Now, we don't know whether that data will be duplicated in larger departments, but that's an astounding possibility that things could change that much just by adding this one one particular piece of technology. Now, we do have to understand also that there are downsides to this, and I wouldn't hide them.
And what are they?
Privacy concerns. I mean, people, no privacy concerns out in public, but police officers end up going into people's homes sometimes. There are people maybe in the camera shot who aren't doing anything and don't want to be on camera. Officers who are having private conversations with citizens or with fellow officers that have nothing to do with police business, that doesn't have to be recorded. And we have to tackle all of that together. But on the whole, these things, I think, will be a net benefit, and I think they're coming. So it's up to us to decide what kind of rules are going to apply when we put these on our police officers.
Jen on Twitter asks, what constitutes interference? It seems that police have wide latitude to charge a bystander with interfering with their duties. So she wants to know about what constitutes interference.
Yeah, that's a great question, because here in Pennsylvania, for instance, police officers, Allegheny County too, police officers, when people were found to be recording them, police officers would charge the citizens with interference with their duties. And you cannot interfere with a police officer when he or she is doing the job. You can video record them as long as you're not interfering. And by now, our law enforcement people like DA Steve Zappala, he has come out and said no more arrests of people for this. So as long as there isn't interference. Now, what is interference, the question here, depends on the facts. There's no better answer than that. And we can certainly define it at the margins. If you're across the street not making any noise, you're far away from the action and you're taping, that's not interference. If, on the other hand, you're trying to, you know, wedge into the scrum of some arrest and get a close-up, that is interference. So if you stay away, you cannot be said to be interfering. Now, I cannot guarantee you wouldn't get arrested, because in some instances, police have arrested people saying something like, well, you're interfering because I told you to stop. Now, that will never hold up, but I can't guarantee you could never be arrested. So as long as police have this antipathy to being recorded, as long as they decide that they can put you through the ringer, even if the case falls apart eventually, there is a risk in doing this recording. But it is the citizen's right to do it. There is no rule against that, no law against that in Pennsylvania, as long as it's in public.
And I want to go back to clarifying something else. And by the way, thank you for that question, Jen. What does the law say about the use of force by police?
Okay, it's a complicated question, but it's one that we really have to understand. You and I, as civilians, only have the right to use force to defend ourselves. We have the right to use as much force as is necessary to defend ourselves against aggressive, illegal force. Police officers have more. They have effectively what's called a privilege to use force to do their job, to carry out their duty. So they have the privilege to use force enough to make an arrest, to bring a person down when necessary, and when force is threatened against them or a civilian, to overcome that force. They cannot use more force than is necessary to overcome the resistance or the force being used against them. So the force has to be proportional and objectively reasonable. So you cannot, for instance, shoot to kill a man who is running away from a police officer who is not posing any threat to the police or anybody else. That is wrong.
Even if the police officer is saying, stop.
It's okay. You got to let him go.
Yeah.
You can't kill him instead.
As was the case in South Carolina.
There had been a law in Tennessee that allowed officers to shoot to kill of any fleeing felon. The Supreme Court said, no, not reasonable. You can't do that unless there's some actual danger of deadly violence by the fleeing felon. And usually there won't be. They're just trying to get away. So we can't use more force than is necessary. So that's why trials of police or investigations of police are talked about in terms of excessive force. Now, that idea that it has to be objectively reasonable, that is obviously a very wide statement that needs to be interpreted almost in every case. And most people who've taken serious looks at the objective reasonableness standard will tell you that it is defined in a way that leaves a lot of discretion to the courts, and therefore court proceedings like civil lawsuits, like criminal cases against police, are not good vehicles for addressing police violence. They typically have a hard time, because what the rule means in practice is is that if you can imagine any reason to use force, if you can imagine any reasonable objective basis for force, it's going to fly, and the officer will not be held accountable. So our law, the use of force, clearly favors the police. That may be for good reasons or bad reasons, but that's what it is right now.
412-246-2002. Let's go to James in Brownsville. James, thanks for waiting. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, Paul, I appreciate you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you too, James.
You do a terrific job on that history of the Civil War. But, Professor, I appreciate what you're doing. And I just wanted to make a left turn, and Paul will let me. Earlier this week, and I might have the facts and the figures wrong, I think a court, I don't know if it was federal or state, ruled against the city of Chicago and the Chicago police that happened back when the Black Panthers were around. And I was listening to Jimi Hendrix, how the FBI and the police of Chicago systematically tried to exterminate Black Panther members and supporters. Can you comment on that, Professor?
I can. I don't have any knowledge of this week's events, but I grew up in Chicago, too, in the same period. And I remember very specifically there was a raid on Black Panther headquarters. People were killed. It was alleged that there was shooting coming out of that headquarters at the police. And when the evidence was examined, there simply wasn't any evidence to support the law enforcement story.
And David, over the years, it's been
debunked.
And David, if I may jump in, this is from USA Today in Chicago. This week, Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced, it was back on Tuesday, so 2 days ago, he announced that the city of Chicago had reached an agreement to provide a sweeping package of reparations to victims of a notorious Chicago police commander who for decades ran a torture ring against suspects. This has been well documented. It's been actually dramatized into a play. These stories have been around, and apparently there's truth to it because the city doesn't hand out money for nothing to victims if there were no victims in the first place.
Absolutely. This is due to the very tangled and tortured saga, if you'll permit me the use of the word, of Lieutenant John Burge, who was an area commander in the Chicago Police Department in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. And there's well-documented evidence that Lieutenant Burge and the people who worked under him would typically take suspects in, and if the suspects did not confess to crimes that Burge wanted a confession, they would torture them with electric shocks, among other things, hook them up to hot radiators, beat them. But the electric shock torture was the common thread through all of it. And there is evidence that this involved well over 100 suspects, some of whom ended up in prison and even on death row for long, long periods. The city and the county never did prosecute John Burge for these actions. They said the statute of limitations ran out, but eventually he testified in a federal lawsuit, and based on his false testimony was tried for perjury and did do some jail time, 4 years. But the stain of this, mostly targeted at African-American suspects, has lived on for decades. And it's about time that this was fully acknowledged. And I know the package includes not only money, but an apology and an acknowledgement and so forth. So this has been, not just in Chicago, but nationally, one of the worst police scandals, I think, in American history. And it's a shame that it's only now that it's being dealt with in some kind of definitive way.
James, thank you for bringing that up. Let's go to Stephen in Greensburg. Stephen? Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead with your comment.
All right. I'll try to keep it as briefly stated as I can.
We are short on time.
Bottom line is, for me, this is an epidemic of the police brutality crossing the line. And And when I saw the footage of the South Carolinian shooting, as Dr. Harris described, it was so horrific to me. I somewhat embarrassingly, but I'm a sensitive person, I sobbed. I mean, the guy just gunned him down, 8 bullets in the back. And so here's my bottom line. The murder in Florida. The guy got off. The Ferguson murder in Missouri. It didn't even get past the grand jury. And so I feel that in South Carolina, with a South Carolina grand jury and a South Carolina jury, if it does go to a trial, I, in my opinion, I give it a 1 in 10 chance of conviction. At least that's a very interesting comment.
I tell you why I disagree with you on the South Carolina case. One sign of just how strong the evidence is there is, I don't know if you noticed, but you know, in Ferguson and in the New York case of Eric Garner, there was a lot of police support for the officer who was under the spotlight. Here, no support from the police. None whatsoever are defending him or saying that this was reasonable. And I think that really speaks volumes, and I do think the evidence against him is good. And if he isn't convicted, I'd actually be kind of surprised. The other cases all stand on their own, and you know, the facts will take them where they take them. I know that a lot of people think that this is an epidemic and it's just getting completely out of control. And I'll just repeat what I said earlier. I don't know that we have evidence that it's worse. I do think there is a greater awareness, a much greater likelihood that we'll have video proof. And it's, you know, when you see it, even on only a cell phone camera, it's just different than hearing a report of it afterwards. And that's why I think that this seems to be a kind of watershed moment. We've got people thinking about this and admitting that these things shouldn't go on and there's too much and so forth. People who would not agree on this in many other situations are coming to realize that whether it's getting worse or just we're becoming more aware of it, we've got to do something because this just can't go on.
Comment from Chris on Twitter says police should be like VFDs and be around only when called. We are out of time, but David, I want to thank you for, again, another very fine and enlightening discussion. David Harris is a professor in the University of Pittsburgh School of Law and a frequent guest on this program. David, as always, great thanks to you.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Coming up, a conversation with the co-editor of the best-selling book, Reach, 40 Black Men Speaking on Living, Leading, and Succeeding, when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The current issue of Time magazine features the bold headline, Black Lives Matter. It's a phrase that has taken on greater significance within the past year. This comes in the wake of killings of black men by white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri, Long Island, and most recently in North Charleston, South Carolina. Concern regarding the lives of black men is one of the driving forces behind the book Reach, 40 Black Men Speak on Living, Leading, and Succeeding, a best-selling book of essays by prominent black men which tells a more up-to-date story about the lives of black men in America. We're joined now in Studio A by the book's co-editor, Trabian Shorters, founder and CEO of Be Me Community, a national network of black men. Trabian Shorters, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
Begin by telling us, if you would, why it is important to look at the stories like these in the book and look at the roles that black men have in society.
Sure. Thank you. So I think it's important to understand that we started this book 2 years ago. So it was before these incidents were hitting in the news, because we're not actually reacting to those incidents. What we were responding to was a recognition that black men have always been assets to America, America's growth, America's prosperity, but have rarely been portrayed that way. There's some reason that in the news and on television, when we hear about or see black men, they are very normally associated with some type of dysfunction, some type of problem. When in our own experience, when you think about it, your own exposure to black men, any of us, that's not our normal experience, and that's because it's not normal in the community. So we made the mistake of allowing the exceptional experience to seem like the rule instead of the exception. So Reach is all about telling the full story, you know, telling the whole story. And we're not ignoring the challenges. In fact, when you look at the book, you will hear about black men who've had real struggles. They've been on the wrong side of the law. They've been on the wrong side of decisions, right? They're not perfect, nothing like that. But they are good people who learn from their mistakes just like everyone does, make a commitment to the well-being of others like most people should. And they lead by example in the type of society that we all want, not just how to defend the image of black men. We're much more genuine than that.
Don't we see those positive images, though, in the media? Maybe not day to day, but they're out there, aren't they? I mean, for example, you know, we put on so much of our media, and if you include things like stamps and posters, you know, Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson, George Washington Carver, those images are there.
Yeah.
So what you're taking issue with is more kind of day-to-day news coverage and activity?
Yeah. So specifically, the examples you gave are all dead men who are considered historic figures, and that's great. But if I were to ask anyone listening if they personally know a black male who has killed someone, which is sort of the most, you know, dramatic image, negative image, most people would say no, right? Do you personally know black men who rob stuff? And I don't mean just people who don't know black people. I mean most people would say no. If I turned around and asked, do you know black men who volunteer? Do you know black men who start businesses? Do you know black men who serve their country? It's an overwhelming yes, because it's that common. And so my thing is, those extraordinary historical figures, even they add this idea that it's exceptional for someone to be on the contributing side of the ledger. And our argument and our evidence is, no, it's normal that black males care about youth development and education and economic opportunity, the same things that we all care about and work on. What I really think it is we need to recognize what is normal and then build upon our contributions. And so reach is about saying whether you're John Legend or whether you're Alex P.A., somebody that most folks have never heard of, or Barrington Irving, just guys that no one has ever heard of. Whether you're those big shots or those little shots, we find great men of inspiration everywhere. And let's balance our portrayal. Let's have a whole portrayal of the black male.
Let's look at the collection of stories in your book about black men in particular. They focus on African-American males as opposed to some other ethnic or social group. And explain why that is.
Sure. There's two reasons for that. One is the organization that I started, which is the group that put the book together, is called Be Me Community. It's a network of inspired black men. That's how we began. And our commitment as black men who are inspired to make a difference is that we will work together to build more caring and more prosperous communities. And we will work with anyone of any race, of any gender, who shares that interest. And I think that's important to understand the context of the book, because we're not saying, let's all get together and defend the black community, right? Which is a good thing. I'm not anti that. But that's not what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is, here are black men who care about education, economic opportunity, youth development, public safety. They care about all the things that we all care about. But unlike most of us, they're willing to lead by example. They'll take initiative on it even if you're not.
So you're talking about somebody, for example, in our community like Roger Humphreys, perhaps?
Yep.
And you're familiar with Roger, prominent jazz drummer, the guy that basically came up with the beat for one of the iconic jazz songs, Song for My Father, who could have kept on recording and stayed on the road but decided, nope, I need to stay home, raise my children, contribute to the community. He taught in the schools for many, many years. That kind of example.
Certainly that guy. And also, you know, Lamon Rucker, who's from Pittsburgh, is featured in the book. And Lamon has been touring with us, talking up these issues of black men, the role of black men in society, these very sort of hot button issues like the shootings. He's been on the road with us talking about how we can recast and rethink about what's going on in our society and how we can work together for the society that we want. So there's the example of the brother who stays home in his community. There's the example of the brother who goes out from his community but never forgets it. You know, Lamon comes back to Pittsburgh. He still cares. He still talks up the town. But he's out there on the stage and in TV and movies, still being an actor and a star. So both. When we say men from all walks, so that's what we're about.
How do you think recent cases like the death of Eric Garner or the shooting of Walter Scott have impacted the way society thinks of black men?
Yeah. Those are dramatic, hurtful, wounding experiences for a lot of black males I know and for black women. And here's what I mean. I have a 22-year-old son. As a father, to know that I can't defend the life of my child when he leaves home is horrifying. To know that the person who killed him can be known, can be identified, can be found to be not to have made good choices, and then to be let go, you know, is horrifying. I don't know how any parent can understand that the society would condone such. That's the negative. The positive is society doesn't condone it, actually. Pew did a study of the George Zimmerman verdict, and they found that the groups who are most dissatisfied with the verdict happen to be the same proportions of the groups who voted for Obama in the first presidential election, meaning that young people, people of color, women, overall, they weren't satisfied with the verdict. And that's the same group that has been showing itself to be a type of voter block of a new conscience, right? And so I'm bringing it up to say, as much as we've gotten accustomed to these horrible stories, there's a whole other generation, a whole other movement that is not accustomed. I don't think they're going to sit still on it. And that's why you've seen it bubbling up.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Trabian Shorters. He is co-editor of the book Reach, 40 Black Men Speak on Living, Leading, and Succeeding. What role do you think Trabian's storytelling has in generating social change? Is there something about the format of this book that can help inspire the kind of discussion or reaction that you would like to see?
Yeah, fantastic question. I actually think the stories you tell create the life that you'll live. It creates the movement. You know, nothing changes without the story. There's a reason that before politicians can get you to go fight in a war, they have to create a narrative that says you must fight in the war, right? Story is how we decide not only who we are, but what matters to us and then what we'll do about it. So we think that is the foundation of any movement and any strategy that you want to undertake. And when you look at the stories in this book, there's actually a couple themes that pop up all the time. One of the themes is the theme of redemption. The fact that people make mistakes, folks fall down. The question is, what do you do once you fall down? You know, do you get back up? Do you decide to make the same mistake again, or do you decide to do something better, something different? So that's one of the themes. Another theme that you'll hear is the role of fathering, right? Whether you had your father in your life growing up or not, the idea of being a father, a community father, someone who looks out for the well-being of those who are coming after us, someone who thinks about how to support the women and the children of the community as well as your brothers. So the themes of Reach, I think, are universal themes. We're at a time where the narrative that says we have to do something about the black male, otherwise he will destroy society. That narrative, I think, is under direct assault. It is archaic. It's outdated. But as this new narrative emerges, and I really do think there's a new narrative emerging, because if you pay attention to the millennials, who are, by the way, the biggest generation in American history, they're markedly different in their views of these things than the rest of us, but they're not particularly in power. I mean, social media, they're popular, but it's coming. So I say that to say, I do think the view that I just articulated is outdated. Archaic is a great word, but I think it's fighting for its survival. There are those who prefer the structure of that.
No doubt.
But I look this way. Folks who have those feelings literally continue to lose market share in the economy. They continue to lose elections. And their time is drawn to a close because they are archaic. But I'm saying people are being asked by the events in the news to decide whether they want to passively agree with it or actively disagree.
My guest has been Trabian Shorters. He is founder and CEO of Be Me Community, a national network of black men, and he is the co-editor of a book called Reach, 40 Black Men Speaking on Living, Leading, and Succeeding. Trabian Shorters, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining me on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Until next time, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.